Thank you, Thomas. I would brief introduce the Taiwan NHI program, but I will focus on the implication to the U.S. system, and maybe I will propose the magic cure to U.S. system, if it is possible. So Taiwan is the last social insurance program. I will skip the data. If you need the data, I will leave it here. I will focus on just the new universalism to 2000. WHO, I thought you already know this. The objectives of the NHI in 1995 is equity, efficiency, micro-efficiency, macro-efficiency, that means affordable, micro-efficiency, that's cost-effectiveness. And please look at the one in red, single-payer system, that's our character. And easy access, mandatory, universal, and affordable by global budget. Some data, just a quick comparison between Taiwan and US. Manpower, we are short, much less than US, and acute hospital bed, a little bit more than US. And hospital discharge, a little bit higher than United States. Length of stay, 9.9, it's much higher than US, 6.5. And discharge to emergency room is going down. Doctor's consultation, it is much more than the US consultation. 12.4 versus about 4 visits per year. Medical technology, we are about the same as Germany, or more than UK, but less than United States. And this one, the fourth one, that's Japan, it's crazy. They have MRI and CT. And about the surgical procedure, look at the center line. Coronary bypass, 12.5 versus 202. I think we do too little, but you need a very strong nutrition program and active program. And financial resources, 70% are from public, and 28% are from private household expenditure. This is important. Allocation of the, you spent $2 trillion in healthcare, but look at the administrative cost, 72.2% versus 2.2% in Taiwan. And the public health, the same, about 3%, about 3.6 versus 3.4. This is our total national health expenditure, 6.02 and versus 15 in US. It is 16 now this year. 99% are enrolled in our system. Premium contribution, 38% are from the insured. The other 62% are from employer and government. And money goes to hospital, of course, 65%, and clinic, 25%, other services. This is the balance of the NHI, that's not important. This one is important. Although we spend less and we don't have so much resources, but the outcome is the same as United States. Of course, we are less than Japan, Germany, but the same as United States. And this is the treatment quality treatment. Breast cancer, we are less. Colon cancer, are less. That's because our staging. If staging adjusted, it is the same. So we have to do screaming strongly. This is organ transplant. That's nothing. But some look at the liver cancer transplant. We have a bunch of hepatitis B. So liver transplant, we are much better than US. But for lung cancer or lung transplant or kidney and heart, we do not do that quite often. This is important, equity and financing fairness. The poor, this is the lowest income they contribute and they get the services 5.2 times. But for the richest, they contribute and they get the services 2.3 times. That means that we subsidize more poor than the rich people. And the fairness index, now we are even higher than Canada or Sweden. This is our administrative cost. It is 1.56. Now, at the beginning, I'm the president and CEO. It is 2.5. Now down to 1.2. We spent to that to the administrative cost. Everyone in Taiwan have this NHIC card. This is me and basic data and what is healthcare data and medical data and administrative data section. And we have a nationwide data warehouse and can do any analyze quality indicator, quality review, reference data, auditing. For example, if you wish to review hospital discharge, for every hospital, we can just display. And this is our satisfaction rate, always higher than 70. If Obama or McCain can have this program, he will be elected. Now, comment and quoted from journals, Health Affairs. This is William Shaw from Harvard School Public Health. He said, single-payer NHI program enabled Taiwan to manage health spending inflation. Another one is from Princeton, Ubi Reinhardt. He said, Taiwan is highly efficient NHI should humble the United States. He said that, I'm not saying this. And this is from our colleague, Dr. Wen. He said, life expectancy after the introduction of NHI improved much for the lower rank health classes. That's important. Another comment is that government commitment is important, and you cannot try to attempt to improve access, quality, and efficiency at the same time. But I don't believe that. I believe we can do that. Now, issues, aging, prevention, long-term care, government commitment, that's our issue, political interference. I just skip this. I will talk about the implication to US. Taiwan's experience is the obvious solution for the healthcare reform in the United States. That's Paul Krugman. He's the Nobel Prize winner in economics this year. What is the implication? I thought, well, the first one is universal coverage and contract of private provider that give us equity and easy access. The second one is cost for inflation. We use single payer and global budget to contain it. The third one will be the government commitment. That's our weak point. With policy, and the more important is ability to implement the program. The fourth one is ICIT. That give us efficiency and waste reduction. What can US do? That's proposed by NAMI, university scholar. Merge all the public health insurance, create a quasi or partial single payer, expand public health program to the children, pupil, student or maternity, they can afford, and allow private commercial insurance enrollee to shift to a cheaper program. This one is joke, but take it seriously. You can contract out all the 48 million in uninsured to Taiwan, so it's only 30 billion. Plus free round trip air ticket, plus 1 week vacation tour coupon, that's 21 billion. That's 50 billion US dollar. Compared to the 2 trillion you spent, it is only 2.5%. And guess which plan can win the public poll? McCain's plan, Obama plan, the academia plan, that's the real one, and the business CEO, that's me, my plan. Who will get the public poll? You guess. This one, please note, this is joke. And this is my disclosure. Thank you.
We have actually a little time that could be for questions. So if some of the audience would care to ask some questions, I think we had a very inspirational series of talks. Any questions? At the back, can you talk loudly? So how does Taiwan plan to handle the changing demographics of long-term care?
I think it's a population structure problem. It is not a problem of long-term care. If our population keep that age structure so rapidly, we cannot handle that. So the only way is to have more baby, have more young. The only way is to initiate, to encourage. Our total fertility rate is 1.1 for a couple. So we have to have more encourage to change the age structure instead of initiate a long-term care program. Thank you.
Don.
Don Ziegler from the American Medical Association. What was the role of the Taiwan Medical Association in supporting, opposing, participating in your single payer reform?
Please repeat the question.
All right. What was the role of the Taiwanese government in supporting the single?
No. Medical Association.
Medical Association, excuse me.
Of course, Taiwan Public Health Association support us, but the Taiwan Medical Association is, they have many argument about the program, but it already there. They had to change the system. They had to suggest to change the system incrementally instead of the reform. People enjoy the system, then they had the voice is negligible.
In the middle here, yeah. Was there a provider satisfaction index?
Of course, it is less than the population, but provider add up to be 200,000 provider. but the population 20 million, who get the strength? The provider only have that's include nurse, physician, all the healthcare workers, but not everyone is dissatisfied with the system. Some physicians like Dr. Ho and they satisfied with the system. If the patient satisfied, the MD, the physician, the surgeon should satisfied with the system. That's my view of the system.
I'll take the one on the left. Left, I left on me. Dr. Murray, what is the DOT strategy?
DOTS is a directly observed therapy short course. It was a strategy for managing TB that evolved from the work of Carol Stieblo in Tanzania, and then WHO took it on board to enhance patient adherence to treatment and improve treatment outcomes.
And next.
Dr. Muriel. Chris Hackney, Major of Public. My question for Dr. Murray is, how has it been received by the NGOs and the governmental bodies who are collecting these data that may not necessarily match what you're seeing in the household surveys? As we know, they don't always match up, and what kind of response are you getting because it can threaten your funding?
So the question is, what's the reaction of governments and NGOs when measurements from household surveys don't line up with what they're reporting? And I think at the heart of that question is a big issue, which is around this sort of shifting to a culture of evidence or accountability for measurement. And if you look, so, you know, one answer is, clearly, if you're worried about advocating for money, or you are trying to portray success of your programs politically, there's always anxiety about alternative measurements. And so that percolates through the system. It's interesting to look to other spheres of social action about their experience. So the one that, of course, is perhaps the most sophisticated about benchmarking is macroeconomic performance. So after World War II, the IMF, the World Bank, put in place a system where pretty much everybody plays by the rules on doing national accounts. So there's not a lot of debate about the reported percent growth, for example, in gross domestic product or the balance of trade, because particularly the IMF invests a lot in sort of supervising those statistical systems, and that's just become accepted as part and parcel of doing business in a globalized economy. That the same acceptance of a set of rules around measurement hasn't occurred so much in all aspects of global health, but has, you know, take the international health regulations for reporting morbidity, there's been enhanced scrutiny from things like SARS and avian flu, so that there's much more recognition that one has to disentangle the motives of the reporter from the evidence that's out there.
At the back in the center. That's it.
Oliver Fine.
So the question relates to this, the rapidity of transition and the implications for the U.S. where there's been a lot of talk about incrementalism.
Yes, we have 13 kind of public insurance before the NHI. We merged it into one national health insurance, plus at that time about 42% of the population are non-insured, but they are the spouse, parents and children of the insurer, because we, at the beginning, we only insure the worker himself or herself. Then we add the 42% dependent to the program, so it's easy to cover the other 42%. Then the 13 public insurance, they are all more or less related. For example, farmer insurance, labor insurance, public servant insurance, serviceman insurance. They are all government insurance, so it's easy to merge. Or else you have a strong insurance like labor insurance and weak health insurance like farmers insurance. They are the poor people, and government employee, they are rich people. They are middle-upper-class people. So we had to merge all the 13 public insurance to be one. Everyone have the same access, same level of care, same benefit package. That's the equity issue instead of efficiency issue. But after merge into one program, you had to have ability to run it. And I happened to be the president and CEO of the that at that time. I almost killed by the physician, but we just do it, and people satisfied with the program. It is incrementally change, not dramatically changed.
I'll take the question up here in the front.
Look at the slide from the global health piece. You can see that as we get more affluent, our problems with body mass index and cholesterol expand as well. And I was thinking of the Surgeon General with regard to childhood obesity. And two questions. One is whether or not there can be a consistent message from organized public health, including the public health service, as to what constitutes an acceptable level of exercise. One of your predecessors, I think it might have been Admiral Satcher, had a prescription that he used to write hand to people. So we hear, 30 minutes a day, 3 days a week or whatever, and probably in the Flight magazine, there's now a machine you can buy it for $15,000. And you want to exercise 4 minutes a day or a week or whatever. So what can be done about a consistency in the message? And secondly, I think about this a little bit the way I did about the campaign against smoking. And no one in a leadership position in medicine would advocate, while advocating cessation of smoking, would be smoking, right? So what can we do to encourage those in leadership positions to kind of model the behavior that we want others to adopt?
I'm going to suggest you repeat the part of the question that you...
Well, the first, and my apologies for the speed that I went through this, but we did just a couple weeks ago, the first part of your question is about national recommendations for physical activity. We just issued the first national federal physical activity guidelines a couple weeks ago, and I recommend reading them. They have target physical activity intervals and type for adults, for children, for seniors, for people with disabilities. You can find that on healthfinder.gov. And then secondly, the modeling question, I can't agree with you more. I think it's extremely important for everyone in public health who can to model good behavior, and just like with smoking, through healthy eating habits and more physical activity, we will make some change. There's a lot of changes that have to happen, but that's one, leadership and setting good examples. It is a component, and I think very important.
Sometimes medicine, many Americans, and I say, what is the guideline say for Yes. The child recommendation is an hour a day of physical activity, and the major point, and two to three times a week of more strength building kind of stretching or really pressing the musculoskeletal system. The key point about this message is it doesn't say you have to do physical activity every single day. It sets a weekly goal to try to be more accommodating to what's really realistic for many people, because the data shows you don't really have to do it every day to get the health benefits. It's really a weekly goal that's been shown. Consistent high levels of physical activity over time have a whole range of health benefits. So if you can do 10 minutes of physical activity, that's good for a day, and then the next day hopefully you'll do more. Loud. I think that's a pretty challenging question. The question is, why has there not been more progress in maternal and child health? The rhetoric is there. You will find that most, if not all, governments have promulgated policies related to MDG-5 as well as to MDG-4. So MDG-4 is child health, MDG-5 is maternal health. And yet, we see that on average, no progress or very limited progress, and in some cases, actually, countries getting worse, particularly for maternal health. There is one type of argument that says low-resourced health systems are only able to handle a limited number of national priority programs. And so some of the people in maternal and child health have argued that the heavy investments and focus driven by the donors in malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV programs have distracted governments from a focus on maternal and child health. Now, to prove that, I think, is a pretty challenging task because of the patchy nature of the data out there. But certainly that's one of the anxieties. And when you couple that with the seeming scarcity of trained nurses, midwives, and physicians in many low-resource settings, there is a competition for the available health workers as new investments come in for these programs. So right now, there's an interesting initiative from WHO, which is called the Positive Synergies Project, trying to look at what lessons can we learn from countries that have been able to simultaneously scale up action for HIV, TB, malaria, and for primary care, particularly maternal and child health, because it is a heterogeneous picture. Some countries have been successful at doing both. Can we learn lessons from those success stories and then hopefully use those to influence what's happened in countries where there seems to have been a negative impact?
I'm going to bring the session to a close. I want to thank our speakers for most illuminating talks and the audience for active participation. Thank you.